Today is August 3rd, 2007. We are at the Atlantic Coastal Federal Bank on 8th and Center Street, Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. Today we are interviewing Roger D. Moore. He was born on February 9th, 1925 in Buffalo, New York. My name is Gerhard Tam, and I will interview Mr. Moore. Helping me will be Don Hill, who operates the recording equipment. As I mentioned before, tell us a little bit first of what happened when Pearl Harbor happened, when you were at age 16, and what your impressions were. From then on, we'll go to enlistment and chronologically. Okay.
My name is Roger Moore, and I grew up in the suburb of Buffalo called Kenmore. That's on the north side. If you're traveling from Buffalo to Niagara Falls, you'll go through Kenmore. Right. I recall very vividly Pearl Harbor Day, and as it was being announced, it was on the radio. It was just past supper time, and we were visiting, my girlfriend and I were visiting with another friend, Betty Atmore, who lived on Euclid Avenue in Kenmore. And I think like most of us at that time, it's a pretty clear recall to be able to know where you were on Pearl Harbor Day. Amongst my friends and myself, there wasn't any hesitation to realize that we were committed, that we had a responsibility, and with really no regrets, I was ready to go, and it was just a case of finishing high school, and then I would be going just into the service. I realized that.
So then, in 1943, your time came.
Yes, sir. In 1943, I had an unusual situation high school-wise, that my graduation came in January of 1943, so that I was really ready to go at that time. And I wanted to enlist in the Navy V-5 program, which is a flight program. And so with the arrangements to get into the V-5 program really took most of about 4 or 5 months. And then I was called, appeared on July 4th, 1943, on a very patriotic day, and I was glad to be going. And my first place of business with the U.S. Navy was at Colgate University. Soloed a Cub, and had other Navy activities at that point, and then we were sent to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, for additional training. From Chapel Hill, I was sent to Glenview Naval Air Station, where we flew the Stearman airplane.
How was your boot camp?
I didn't go to boot camp.
You didn't get to boot camp?
I went directly to Colgate.
Oh my!
This is the Navy at the time had a Navy V-5 program for flyers and a Navy V-12 program for those officer training in various colleges. Getting back then to Glenview Naval Air Station, after I'd had about 80 hours of flight at Naval Air Station, the Navy found, very fortunately, that their losses of pilots in the war up to that time had been much less than they had anticipated. So I'm told that there were about 27,000 cadets training for their wings. And because the losses were so small, they cut that program in half right overnight. So I was caught in that purge. The Navy gave me a wonderful break at that time, asking me what Navy school I might want to go to, and this was after we had been sent to Great Lakes Naval Air Station, Great Lakes Naval Station, not Air Station. in Great Lakes. I chose the photography school, which is at Pensacola, Florida, and was sent immediately there and immediately started training, which was a good assignment. I had hoped at that point that I would become an aerial photographer, and that was part of the training. However, rather than being sent as an aerial photographer, I was sent to the Anacostia Photolithography School, which is just outside of Washington, D.C. Then the big step came at that point. While I was at the Photolithography School, which was attached to the Navy Department, at the Navy Department building, I saw on a bulletin board a notice asking for Navy personnel, they gave various categories, who including photography, who would be interested in taking an assignment that was considered prolonged and hazardous. And at my age and at that time, having already been in the Navy and not seeing any action and so on, that sounded very interesting to me, so I volunteered for that program. Not knowing where it was going to take me or even anything about it, all I knew was just they wanted to know if I was interested in that program. It might have been submarines, as an interest. I found out then that secretively, we were going to be going to interior China for a very special program that the Navy had, which was not publicly publicized. Very quickly then, they got us to San Pedro, California, and put us on a troop transport that was to take us for this assignment. The troop transport went out of San Pedro. We took 60 days to go to Calcutta, India, on the troop transport, dodging the threat of submarines all the way over. That, of course, took us across the equator. We celebrated that. And we had one stop in Melbourne, where we weren't allowed to get off the ship. Only the ship's company got off the ship. Then we went into Calcutta. From Melbourne, the troop ship took us to Calcutta, India, and that was just a stopping off place, even though the group, and now I know the name of the group was called the Sino-American Cooperative Organization, and of course was shortened to SACO. And SACO had people that were like their ship's company who were there, and they provided us with billeting as we waited for our flight. And our flight was to be a DC-3 to fly over the Himalayan mountains, or over the hump, as it's spoken of. And so we put our time in playing ping pong and whatever else there. I did have a camera available to me, so I did take quite a few pictures of the people of Calcutta.
What kind of camera did you have?
I had a used Foch Derby, which took 127 size film, that was something I had bought in Washington while I was there, which so I'd taken along, and so I had taken some pictures on the troop ship as well when I went over there. But there wasn't any photo lab set up for us in Calcutta, and there wasn't any real reason that we would need one. So within about 30 days, my time came to fly into Kunming, China. I right away in Kunming saw such a real difference between China and India. The poverty in Calcutta was oppressive. It was just awfully hard to take and think that the people are living that way. Whereas in Kunming, the Chinese were of a much happier mood and were productive with their farms and that sort of thing. Kunming, incidentally, is a garden spot for travelers and all, and it's attractive now for people who go there. Rice paddies built on the side of a mountain, and just make quite a beautiful scenes all the way through there.
Now, Roger, let me ask you something. You were in the Navy, right?
So
what were you doing inland so far?
Now I'm learning more about Sakhalin, and that's a good question, because we're learning now that in China, in the interior, that Sako is operating weather stations that will forecast the weather to the fleet in the Pacific. That is number one significance at the time. We also are training Chinese guerrillas, and in particular in preparation for what might have been an invasion of China to get at Japan if the bomb had not been used. So that these guerrillas were to take photographs and to prepare for a section of the China coast in the vicinity of Formosa, where there would be a landing that would take place as the Marines were taking islands out in the Pacific and getting closer and closer to Okinawa and so on. That this was going to be the strategy that, because of course they weren't anticipating the bomb at that time. So my particular assignment was to prepare a manual, and we had folding Kodak cameras that we, and the manual would be converted into Chinese, and that the Chinese would be using these cameras to take pictures that in preparation for those landings. Under our supervision, the Sino-American Cooperative Organization was to be, just as the name said, a group that would be working together to as Chinese troops with American troops. The American troops were going to be more advisors, but they were also active. They besides the weather stations and the training of the guerrillas, we were very much involved with the community, helping also helping the locally, but more important, we were also rescuing downed aircraft and working quite closely with the Clara Chenault group.
Ron, what time was it? What month and what year?
Oh, that's a good question. I had arrived in Calcutta in the March or April of 1945. Let me see if I've got that right. Yes, I arrived in Calcutta late March or early April 1945. I was there for approximately a month before we got our flight over the hump. Then that put me in Kunming. We weren't in Kunming very long before we were flown then to Chongqing. Now, Chongqing was a pretty rugged town at that time and not much more of a town. But it was headquarters for the Chinese government, Chiang Kai-shek, and it was who were, of course, the nationalists. And this is before the time of the communists. But the communists versus the nationalists, and the intervention of the United States was a very important mix of what was going on there at that time. In Chongqing was a outpost about, as I recall, about 10 or 12 miles outside of Chongqing, called Happy Valley, and that's where Sako headquarters were located. And I set up, with the help of others who had gone with me, particularly my friend Bob Grace, We set up a photo lab at Happy Valley, where we were then given various assignments that photographic assignments, and my particular assignment was in preparation of trying to help the Chinese guerrillas photograph the coast of China.
Yeah, now, you also mentioned something about rescuing Allied flyers.
Yes.
Did you meet any of those flyers?
I did not. I'm not taking any credit for that personally. That was only part of the organization was involved in that. And just backing up to Kunming for a minute, and Kunming was at the northern end of the Burma Road, and so that was a Claire Chennault territory for the Flying Tigers. So again, with the organization, not with me personally, there was cooperation with Chennault in doing that. Later on, I took photographs of Claire Chennault in the Chongqing Airport.
Should we start?
Yeah.
One of the things that I might mention about Chongqing was that in flying in and flying out and whatever trips we had there, the landing strip for Chongqing, and of course these were only DC-3 propeller type aircraft, the landing strip was a sandbar in the Yangtze River. And as you came in for an approach or took off, there were shacks and homes and so on built on the cliffs. And you could see the wash hanging out there and look right into somebody's kitchen and so on as you flew in and out of there. This was a makeshift capital for the nationalist government to even have us there. But the other thing that I should mention is that in the formation of SACO, Admiral King appointed then commander Marion Miles, who was an old China hand, as we talk about, had a lot of experience in his early career in the Navy. And he told him to make the contact with Chiang Kai-shek for the organization that the United States would do cooperatively with the nationalist Chinese. Marion Miles then was introduced by Chiang Kai-shek to a general of the Chinese army named Tai Li. Tai Li was a very, very strong personality and had the respect of everybody, not because he was a good guy either. He had respect because he was a tough guy. They then set it up, and it wasn't popular with Washington in a lot of cases because Marion Miles conceded that the lead for the SACO would come from the Chinese. And so, of course, the brass in Washington did not like to see that kind of an arrangement. But Admiral Miles saw that it was the only way to set up and run this organization. Then Bill Donovan of the OSS and other folks who were there resented the Navy being here in China at this time, doing guerrilla type work and doing the training and setting up the weather stations because Donovan thought that it should be an OSS type assignment. So all this was happening around Chongqing at that time. Then the big change for me and for SACO and for the whole world was VJ Day that came in August of 1945. I think it was the 15th. The notice was given to us all immediately. It seems to me that by the 18th or 19th, we were in Shanghai. And the reason for us being taken to Shanghai so quickly was that the Japanese had full control of Shanghai and all of the other major parts of China. The Japanese were running all the commerce of China. Now, this might not have affected the lives much of somebody living in the interior of China, the Chinese I'm speaking of, but it sure affected those people who were on the coast. And the U.S. government wanted to have a and a wide presence there in Shanghai and in the other major parts just as quickly as we could.
Well, let me ask you, Roger. You went to Shanghai.
Yes, sir.
The Japanese were still armed, weren't they?
Yes.
How did that make you feel?
Well, my first assignment with my camera was to take photographs of some Japanese mine tenders and smaller naval craft that were there. And so I went down to the harbor and to the docks, and I was, in fact, the first one to be in contact with the Japanese crew that had been. They were laying on their bunks just wondering what they were supposed to do next. They weren't fighting, and there was no fight left in them. And they were there waiting to find out who was going to tell them what to do next. So I have in my file, I have lots of pictures of Japanese crews and the captain of that ship. I don't know for sure what his rank was, but he was the captain of the ship. He was laying on his bunk in the wheelhouse when I got aboard there. So we were really rushed into Shanghai just as quickly as we possibly could. And wouldn't be up to a photographer to have anything to do with how those people were given orders and what they did next, but they were sure waiting for orders when I was there.
Now you went in there, just U.S. Navy personnel or just Chinese?
I was traveling with my fellow photographer, period. The amount of armament that I, the only time I really saw armament when I was with Sako, was I had a 45 Colt pistol on my hip, which I never used. But it was the only time we thought that we really needed a weapon. There in Shanghai, we set up our photo lab at a building on the Bund. Now, if you've seen over the years pictures of Shanghai, how do you identify Shanghai? They'll show you a picture of the Bund, which were beautiful capitalist buildings all along the waterfront. And that was also the main terminal of ships that came in, particularly passenger ships. And the building that the Navy took over for their operations in Shanghai was the Glenline building. Glenline was... I don't think it still exists. Glenline was a big shipping company, British owned, and they had our building was 8 or 10 stories high, and we were assigned a portion of one floor for our lab. I might also mention, as far as it, with the Sako group, we were. Guerrillas and traveling somewhat incognito. We were paid a per diem. The enlisted man was given $7 a day, and the officers were given $11 a day. However, the Navy did provide us with housing and dining room regardless, so that this was an incentive given for the fact that I guess that we had volunteered for this kind of duty. In Shanghai, my housing was at the Shanghai American School, and the name aptly describes what the building was about. It was a sprawling campus with a nice lawn in front of it in what is known as the French area. And our dining was also provided for us. There were various hospitals at the time. We had different assignments as in work with the Navy ships that came into the harbor. One I remember had quite a bit of work to do photographically was with the Repose. The Repose was a Navy hospital ship. And the repose people were taken care of the Navy personnel who were there, and I think also of some particular cases with the Chinese. We got along very well with the Chinese. I was really so taken with the Chinese people that I did a series of photographs of the people who I thought were like the working people and who showed a tremendous amount of courage. They'd been under the oppression of the Japanese for about 10 years, particularly in a city like Shanghai. But there was no give up in these people. They had a good outlook. They were friendly with us. Of course, we were their liberators. But even so, the troops are not always welcome, as we find these days. But they were very, very friendly and hospitable to us in many cases. I personally met a couple who were. She was Chinese. The wife is Chinese. The husband was Danish, and he ran the Shanghai power plant. He was Mr. Top Dog of the Shanghai power plant, and I did not want to get personal with him to ask him about his situation when the Japanese were there. But he was the brains that were needed, and the city needed power, and he stayed there while the Japanese were there and ran the power plant. There's a story I think I should mention. We've had a lot of fun with it, the Nsako group. I think that VJ Day came on the 15th of August. And on the 19th of August, some couple hundred miles above Shanghai, Swede Swensel, who was one of our group, I think he was a lieutenant commander at the time, doesn't really matter. He was bringing two Chinese junks down in a bit of a celebration that the war is over and the Navy should take control of the shipping on the river and so on. And this is like a two-masted sailing boat, this Chinese junk. This is no motorizing. He's got a pair of these and he's coming down the river towards Shanghai. And he receives some unfriendly fire from another Chinese junk and it determines that he is encountering Japanese that don't want to give up. And so here it is 4 days after VJ Day and the war goes on. But Sweden, the tradition of our Sako group, knocks out the Japanese junk and takes it as a treasure to be brought down into Shanghai with his junk. And I was fortunate enough, a fun thing like that, I got to say fortunate enough, to be there and on assignment with my camera, and I got some pictures of the conquering junk as it arrived in Shanghai with a lot of fanfare and fun with it for the U.S. Navy there. There are lots of stories that I really like aren't stories, but about Shanghai. Shanghai is the most cosmopolitan international city, I think, of all that I've been connected with, for sure. But I'm not heard of anything that is quite like that. Where there were the areas where the French area really was also British and German and other nationalities are there, but they were Caucasian, and they lived well, they lived high off the hog, and were very special. They had a very special attitude, not always good, before the war, and there was a little of that that carried over when I was there. But one of the things that I wanted to mention is that when we first got there, I went out to the Shanghai airport. The name for the moment escapes me. took some pictures of the aircraft that were out there at that airport that were military aircraft that the Japanese had left. There were Chinese now. Chinese troops had been now put there to guard them. It was sometime after that, quite a long time after that, that I was aware in the 1990s that Steven Spielberg made a movie that was called The Empire of the Sun. And The Empire of the Sun was about a young boy at an internment camp outside of Shanghai, and how he was treated by the Japanese, and he was only 12 years old, and his growing up. So I'm realizing some many years after my Shanghai experience that I got in on what would be the Spielberg movie, which ends with the VJ Day. It really was a warm experience for me to find that airport that I had visited while I was there was right next door to the internment camp that they had for the Europeans who were there.
Are we ready?
Well, thank you for asking me for these experiences in Shanghai, because I think you can tell I enjoyed talking about them. Anyway, I was there in Shanghai until the spring of 1946, and then was allowed to come home on the basis of points, how long had you been in the service, and how long had you been overseas, and so on and so forth. And it was very systematic, and that worked out very well. We left Shanghai and went up to Tsingtao to pick up some other troops up there. Just as the name Tsingtao comes up, I want to mention that there's a Tsingtao beer that we enjoyed very much while we were there, named for the fact that the brewery was in Tsingtao River, but we went with the ship. From Tsingtao, we sailed directly across, didn't take 60 days, directly across the Pacific, and came home to San Diego. That was an interesting period for me. I was fortunate that I wasn't in combat, and I was fortunate that I enjoyed the experience that I had. And then there was another very fortunate experience right after that, and that is that we were given the GI Bill, which paid for our college education, and I'm very grateful for that.
So tell us how you returned to the States, you went to San Diego, and you got out of the Navy in 1946?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. In 1946, I enrolled at the University of Rochester. And from my experience with cameras and photography, I wanted to go to optics school. And found out in the first half of the first semester that was over my head. And I no way, what, and the main reason that it was over my head is I had to take German, to learn German language. And languages that I knew were not my forte. So through my counselor, I then switched from the physics course, optics, I switched to mechanical engineering, which it worked out well for me because I have the engineering training has been very good. My work has been, until I retired in 1990, my work has been building bridges, so I should have been a civil engineer, but I, in fact, was a mechanical engineer, and that went okay, too.
But you still stayed a little bit in photography, right?
I've kept my hand in photography, both taking family pictures, I have three children, and also the photography I use with my business, taking photographs of jobs that we were bidding, that we would have them to look at as we were preparing our bids. and also as-built photographs of the work that was done. So, however, when I did get here to Amelia Island, I've been very inspired by the natural life that's here, the wildlife that's here, the trees that are more of Georgia style and so on. I've just been very impressed, and I've done a lot of photography here.
But when did you come to Fernandina?
In 1990, my wife and I explored the Barrier Islands from Charleston down here to Amelia Island, and we didn't feel like we had to have Florida as an address. We were just looking for where we thought it was the best arrangement, and she sure helped me pick. She wanted good hospitals and a university, and so in that case, the Amelia Island with Jacksonville so close by won out.
Well, Roger, this was a fantastic story. This concludes the interview. Thank you very much for sharing your recollection with us here and with the nation. We're proud of you.
Thank you very much.